markets less than 2 weeks after Finance Minister Kwasi Kwarteng's announcement of his mini-budget sparked market turmoil and blistering political attacks.
Will the Chancellor now put aside his pride, do the right thing for our country, end this trickle-down nonsense and reverse the budget?
The response from the finance minister, defiant, despite his recent U-turn on tax cuts for the highest earners.
She should get her facts right. The IMF today have said that our growth is going up.
What the IMF has also said is that high levels of inflation will persist longer in Britain than in almost all other advanced economies.
The answer they're going to try and give to this is to say, actually get the economy to grow. But it's very difficult to get the economy to grow if the rest of the world economy is actually shrinking at the moment. So if we're by cutting taxes, they say we'll get things going. Well, actually, at the moment, what they're trying to do is actually slow the economy down to control inflation. That's what the Bank of England's doing. But the government is moving in the opposite direction and adding inflation to it. This doesn't make sense to us.
The Chancellor hasn't made it clear where the cuts will fall. The National Health Service has the largest budget, but cutting that isn't realistic. The Prime Minister is committed to increase defense spending, which leaves other areas, such as education and welfare, looking vulnerable again.
Well, that was done before when we had to go through a period of austerity, and that was very unpopular indeed. If they're going to go through that again, they're going to be very unpopular, and it's not going to be accepted, I don't think. So it's going to be interesting to see which bit they're going to try and cut. Or are they really just going to bank on growth, in which case we can't see how they're going to do it.
More than 24 million Britons live on some sort of benefit. A further reduction is unthinkable.
The UK economy shrank unexpectedly in August. Inflation is at nearly 10%. Interest rates are up. Pension funds are on the brink. Faith in the government shaken. And with the Bank of England's intervention in the markets ending this week, is another U-turn by the government in the offing. Saipur is up, London.
A general strike and civil disobedience have been observed in occupied East Al-Quds and in many areas of the occupied West Bank to reject Israel's siege on Shafat refugee camp and Anata town northeast Al-Quds. Since Saturday, the Israeli military has kept over 130,000 Palestinians in the two areas under forced lockdown after sealing all military checkpoints. The siege has disrupted residents' vital interests. It has prevented them from accessing the rest of the city for work, school and medical care and other necessities in severe violation of their basic rights. Israeli military says the move comes as they are searching for a Palestinian gunman who killed an Israeli female soldier at a checkpoint at the entrance to Shafat on Saturday.
What goes on in these actions by the Palestinians are a normal response to the Israeli brutality and aggression against Shafat refugee camp and Anata town. The strike is meant to lift the siege imposed on Shafat and Anata, Al-Quds, Qalandia refugee camp, and other towns. We all responded to the call of civil disobedience and strike.
Also on Wednesday, the Israeli forces imposed a closure on the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, a day after an Israeli soldier was shot dead near an illegal settlement in the area. In addition to the major military checkpoints surrounding the city, dirt mounds have been placed on the Nablus area roads by military bulldozers to prevent Palestinians to use alternative exits. A manhunt is still underway to find the shooter. Israeli media revealed that the military was considering launching a large-scale operation in the northern West Bank in a bid to end the recent phenomena in struggle, armed struggle.
The resistance of the Palestinian people, and especially the armed resistance, as it happened in Jenin, and it moved to Nablus, and now from Nablus, we hope that it will be spreading all over the West Bank in order to resist this occupation. The phenomena that we are witnessing today in Nablus, this is the new way for the Palestinians to express their anger of this occupation, especially and particularly that all other political solutions is totally failed.
In recent months, the Israeli army have launched near daily raids to the West Bank, mainly in Jenin and Nablus, where Palestinian armed resistance is becoming more organized and new groups of fighters have been formed, the most popular now known as the Lion's Den. Despite Tel Aviv's heavy-handed crackdown and collective punishment of Palestinians, they are keeping up their resistance against the regime using different tools. Every day, the Palestinians prove that the Israeli military's aggressive measures have failed to weaken their struggle. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
The EU's temporary protection directive has been specifically activated to help Ukrainian refugees. It means they are guaranteed housing, healthcare, education and welfare payments in any of the bloc's 27 member states.
I would like today to announce that the temporary protection directive will continue to be in place at least until March 2024.
The European Commission has also launched a scheme to make it easier for millions of Ukrainians in the EU to find jobs. At the same time, thousands of refugees fleeing other conflict zones continue to sleep on the streets throughout the bloc. Also, as the cost of living crisis in the EU intensifies, activists say the bloc's own citizens are not receiving adequate support.
Nowadays we see that people can be homeless and have a job. There's in-work homelessness, but there's also groups that are higher risk of losing their job from one day to the next.
As the war in Ukraine continues, the EU is pondering a ninth round of sanctions against Russia. Moscow's ally Belarus is also very likely to be targeted for cooperating with Russia.
All these steps, especially by the Belarusian regime, are against the will of the majority of the population and will be met with new and strong restrictive measures from the side of the European Union.
There have been renewed calls in the European Parliament for less focus on sanctions, less focus on arming Ukraine, and more focus on peace talks.
We need diplomats to finally take action. This is the view of 77% of all Germans. Political offers need to be made in order to encourage both sides to lay down their weapons.
According to many analysts, Western sanctions against Russia are clearly not working. Otherwise, a ninth package would not be on the agenda. In fact, economists say the current sanctions are hurting EU citizens far more than had been anticipated. Inflation and interest rates continue to rise with no clear end in sight. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A new study covering a huge range of foreign policy issues found that a whopping 79% of Americans believe that the United States should continue to pursue negotiations with Iran. On almost no other key foreign policy question is there such broad support across generations and political affiliations.
Most Americans are heavily fatigued by endless wars and, you know, U.S. Foreign policy adventurism overseas, and, you know, really want political leadership, regardless of which party we're talking about, that is concerned with, you know, more pressing domestic needs.
The study's authors even declared that politicians who criticize diplomatic efforts with Iran are out of step with many of their voters. Joe Biden campaigned on a diplomatic return to the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy program. In a major backtracking, not only has he not continued to uphold the United States' end of the deal, but he has imposed round after round of new sanctions on Iran. From the Washington Beltway to Hollywood, Iranophobia, Islamophobia, and violent belligerence towards Tehran has been pushed by America's political, media, and academic elites. However, the poll seems to prove that these messages have been emphatically rejected by the average American.
The level of sway that the defense industry has over Washington, the defense lobby, and the military-industrial complex, that's who the two major parties are beholden to. There's no real significant difference between the Republicans or the Democrats. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned the Iran deal. That's a perfect example.
The poll noted that for the fifth straight year, the percentage of Americans who think the U.S. should negotiate directly with adversaries has grown, now reaching 65%. Two-thirds of America supports the country's total withdrawal from Afghanistan. 40% of people declaring an opinion believe that the U.S. has not responded well to the unrest in Ukraine. The only foreign policy issue which gained as much support as diplomacy with Iran was that 80% of Americans demand more congressional oversight in the executive branch's ability to unilaterally declare wars. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The 2022 EU Ambassadors Conference was launched on Monday in Brussels against the backdrop of the war in Ukraine and its global consequences. Ambassadors from the EU's 145 delegations and offices around the world took part.
This is a perfect storm. First, prices increasing. Everybody's running to increase interest rates. This will bring us to a world recession.
Tensions between the West and Russia are rising. One official in Moscow claims a truck was used to attack the Crimean bridge last Saturday and had travelled through EU nation Bulgaria. The European Commission was asked to respond.
There are so many things coming out of Moscow and from these official so-called places which don't really merit any commentary. I mean, let me recall that the Crimea is Ukraine.
No one has yet claimed responsibility, but some analysts say the move was a strategic mistake.
The threats of a nuclear conflict are becoming more and more real. And I think it wasn't wise, it was really provocative to attack the bridge, especially military. Whoever did it, they haven't reached any significant result because the bridge resumed functioning the very same day.
12 months ago, EU agency the European Court of Auditors determined Ukraine is corrupt to the core. Despite this, the nation is set to become part of the EU's long-term budget. The European Commission says Kiev needs 3.5 billion euro per month to run the country.
Since the beginning of the war, we have supported Ukraine financially with Esteem Europe with up to 19 billion euros. This is not including the military capability and equipment support.
Fighting intensified on Monday as Russia's military struck Kiev and other Ukrainian cities. The latest position from the West's perspective is due to become clearer later this week when a meeting of NATO defence ministers takes place here in the Belgian capital. Also, an EU leader summit is due to take place here at the end of next week. Analysts are not anticipating there will be many references made to peace talks. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A study presented by the Bank of Italy on Monday raised the alarm on the Italian company's sentiment on the future. According to the report, based on information gathered between August 15 and September 15, spiraling inflation and uncertainty linked to the conflict in Ukraine have badly dented optimism. The Bank of Italy surveyed companies in the industrial and service sectors with at least 50 employees.
Bank of Italy's data was somehow predictable. One just needs to talk to people to realize how worrying the situation is. Maybe we must be aware that the financialization of the economy, a long-standing issue, is aggravating the economic situation and that companies must stop seeking high profits in a short span of time.
A third of the firm surveyed said difficulties related to rising energy costs had worsened in the previous 3 months, sparking a downward revision in the investment plans for the remainder of the year. The war between Ukraine and Russia has made an Italian energy crisis much worse. Italy received 40% of its gas imports before the conflict from Russia.
We are witnessing a spike in energy prices, which is only partially due to a shortage of supplies and also has roots in speculative strategies which threaten thousands of companies and alarm families.
The leader of a right-wing coalition that won elections about 2 weeks ago, Giorgia Meloni, is likely to become Italy's next prime minister. Meloni will face no shortage of challenges, from the budget and recovery plans to finding unity with allies and deciding how to handle the Ukraine-Russia war. So far, the Mario Draghi's government has spent 66 billion euros in an attempt to shield firms and families from surging energy costs.
Italy's finances are set to be further put to the test as analysts predict the next government will be forced to increase fiscal aid or even to resort to a budgetary slippage. Max Civilli, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran's leader has highlighted the importance of Islamic unity in preserving the Muslims' common interests and foiling the plots of arrogant powers. In an address to participants of a conference on Islamic unity held in Tehran, Ayatollah Khamenei has warned that divergence among Muslim nations has paved the way for intensified atrocities against Palestinians by Israel. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll try to shed some light on the root causes of such divergence and its consequences for Muslims. On tonight's Spotlight, we have Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas El Najem, joining us from Toronto. And also attorney, activist, and political analyst, Zakir Ahmed Maya, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
General, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. El Najem in Toronto, leader of the Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says, the Muslim world can claim its rightful place in global geopolitics through unity. How important is this issue of unity?
Yes, would like to congratulate the Muslim world and all the lovers of the Prophet Muhammad on the anniversary of his birth. And this was the central point of why they were meeting here and having this unified conference and inviting Sunni and other sects of the Muslim faith to come to Iran and to speak about the important facts and the problems that the Islamic Ummah is facing. And the unity is actually the essential key to strengthen this Ummah, meaning this nation, and to defeat the enemies, because the enemies You know, their plots and their project is to divide and conquer. And to cause seditions is one of their main goals. And they've been doing that in many different Muslim countries. Once they were able to, you know, invade and interfere in the internal affairs of these countries. And we've seen what happened, for instance, in Afghanistan. We've seen what happened in Iraq. We've seen what happened in Syria. We've seen what happened in many countries before that, even Lebanon, where the U.S. were, and their allies, obviously, and their puppets, were working to cause sectarian strife and, you know, cause internal problems and divisions. And, you know, the bloodshed that happens, it causes problems for the future, that people want to avenge and people want to, you know, fight for their rights or what they've lost. And at that point, this will just gradually keep bringing, you know, problems to the Islamic Ummah. But we got through this phase recently in certain countries because they were able to unite and were able to fight the enemy and understand the problems and the issues that we're dealing with. And Sayyid Khamenei is a very wise leader. He has kept the Islamic Republic of Iran and all the Muslims inside Iran unified. And he's also issued Islamic you know, laws where he says that it's not permissible and it's you cannot disrespect high figures and revered figures of other sects, especially the Sunni Muslims, because they are the majority in the Islamic world, you know, as a population of Muslims. And he's always tried to maintain that unity. While we have other puppet regimes that are working for the U.S. and for the interests of Britain, such as the Saudi regime that is, you know, that has the Wahhabi sect as their state-sponsored doctrine, have always worked to cause divisions and hatred and sectarian strife and killings and bloodshed between Muslims. And this affected the whole Islamic world. And we see what they tried to do that and implant that also in Yemen recently, but they failed because of the wise leadership of, for instance, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi. And we've seen the wise leadership of Sayyid Sistani, that even when holy shrines in Iraq that are very revered and important and holy for the Shia Muslims were bombed, they were okay. Sayyid Sistani quickly called for you know, unity and to not fall for these traps of you know, sedition and internal you know, problems.
Let's bring in our guest from Johannesburg, Zakir Ahmed Mayet, in on the discussion as well on the issue of sowing divisions among Muslims. Ayatollah Khamenei says enemies have been seeking to drive a wedge among Muslims by creating and empowering Israel. I want to get your thoughts on that comment. And who benefits, actually, from these divisions?
Definitely. The tactic of the Western world and imperial powers has always been to divide and conquer. It has been a principle that is enshrined in their military doctrine and as well as their foreign policy stances. So it comes as no surprise when the illegitimate state and the foreign body and the cancerous body of the Zionist entity is placed within the heart of the Muslim world and exercises its foreign policy and military policy in line with what I've just described. The only party that succeeds from these types of divisionist policies are those that are seeking to destroy the Ummah and those that are seeking to occupy and perpetuate apartheid. Those that are the victims are the unwitting individuals that fall into the trap of sectarianism, takfiri ideology, and finds problems and divisions amongst their own brethren. This is a clear indication that we are deviating from the law of Allah, the law of the Creator in Surah Al-Imran. It is very clear, and hold firmly onto the rope of Allah and do not divide amongst yourself. The Almighty says very clearly there that if you have divided amongst yourselves, you were fighting each other once upon a time, and you are on the edge of the pit of hellfire, and He has saved you from that. What does that mean? That when you fight amongst yourselves, when you find fault amongst yourselves, that is where hellfire awaits you. And this is the clearest indication, and the respected leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Ali Sayyid Khamenei, has given that nasiha, that advice, to the Ummah and humanity at large. We are fighting for truth and justice. They spoke about the just war and the just peace, and that is what a Muslim seeks, the Ummah seeks. It's justice for each and every one of them. and including the larger population, mankind. Therefore, deviating from that would mean that we are aligning ourselves with Zionist powers, we are aligning ourselves with imperial powers, and if we hold firmly to the rope of God, do not divide amongst ourselves, fight for truth and justice, it is very clear that we find ourselves opposing imperialism, opposing Israel, opposing colonialism.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Mayet. Also, Ayatollah Khamenei said in his address, the unipolar world in which one or two states impose their will on other countries is no longer accepted, and that this quote-unquote unipolar world order is losing its legitimacy. What is your perspective on those comments? Are we on the cusp of a major geopolitical power shift, in your opinion?
Most definitely, we're seeing it now. In fact, this isn't the analysis of just our own circles or the respected supreme leader, not at all. This is the analysis from even the Western world. If you look at Colonel Douglas McGregor, he has spoken about this. Individuals such as Jordan Peterson, although we may disagree with many of the views that these individuals have expressed, what we cannot deny is that they even see the writing on the wall. And the writing is very clear. This is a cultural war from the Western world versus Russia, where they're trying to impose their values upon Russia and trying to reestablish the unipolar world, where Russia has now taken a very clear stance with the rest of the BRICS countries. And they are now pushing back and they're saying, no longer are we going to accept this. What does this mean? What does this spell out for the ordinary individual? The ordinary individual now is empowered. We are no longer subject to the hand of U.S. imperialism, where they can parade through the world under the banner of trying to liberate us, while it's more like looting our resources, destroying our people, and inflicting a pure occupation that is nothing short of inhumane, barbaric, and a pure violation of international law. So what we have now in before us is a very exciting time for the world right now. Yes, there's turmoil. Yes, there's death and destruction. But the world is being rewritten. And this is what the respected leader is drawing our attention to, is that the world map is being rewritten in such a way that we hope that the structures of imperialism, colonialism, and apartheid are going to be debunked and unhinged, and what we will see is a new just world order where it's not a unipolar world, but one that is in balance.
For us and Najim, elsewhere in his address, Ayatollah Khamenei pointed to the Palestinian issue and normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime. He described the normalization of ties between some Muslim countries and the Israeli regime as one of the biggest acts of betrayal. Do you see it in that light as well? And what are these countries gaining from this betrayal?
I mean, the height of this betrayal is just large, you know, because it's huge. I mean, it's very painful that every day we hear about the atrocities and the crimes that the Zionist regime commits inside Palestine. Today they killed a doctor. A few days ago they killed a little child, you know, an infant. A few days before that, you know, today they killed also another two youth, as I read. I mean, it's continuous, you know, this even just the rhetoric of the Zionists and the settlers and some of these politicians that are in the Israeli regime, you know, calling for the shooting of Palestinians that throw rocks. For instance, today there was an extremist politician. These criminals, day and night, you know, commit these gruesome crimes and barbaric crimes and hurt the Muslim Ummah by also this, you know, disrespecting the Holy Aqsa Mosque. And, you know, how could you go towards and incline towards supporting those people that are killing your own people? Like, you're supposedly Muslim. So when you see another Muslim and he's being, you know, oppressed, you're supposed to stand with him and support him. And you're going towards helping the oppressor and growing his movement. This is a great betrayal, and this is also causing disunity between the Islamic Ummah, and it's also causing a distortion between the nations itself. For instance, the nations of the nation of UAE or the nation of Bahrain, the nation itself, they remember when they were watching, you know, clips and videos of the Palestinians, or they were taught in school to support the Palestinians, and all of a sudden their government now or their regime started to teach them that, no, we should support the Israelis. This is causing major confusion and distortion and dividing the Ummah instead of them getting closer to the oppressed people. And we see, you know, the Hajj, for instance, the holy pilgrimage of Hajj. This shows a unity of all Muslims praying towards one place. And we should all remember that this Qibla, this direction was before, long time ago, was Al-Aqsa, was Masjid Al-Aqsa. This is where we all pray towards, and this place is occupied, and our Muslim brothers and sisters and humanity is suffering over there, and something has to happen. We need to support these Muslim people. And Sayyid Khamenei is one of the main leaders and the primary leader supporting the Palestinian cause. You know, not just by speaking. No, his nation and his government and his army and his forces are supporting the Palestinians by arming them up, by the media such as Press TV speaking about the Palestinian issue all day and night, undeterred. By him even all the time wearing the kufiya. Every time Sayyid Khamenei comes out, you see him wearing a kufiya, is the Palestinian symbol. Which other leader does this, that always wears this and remembers the Palestinian cause on his shoulders? He carries this burden on him because he cares about the Palestinian nation. And right now, there's a major campaign in the world to try to divide the Iranian nation because they're so fearful of this great leader and this great government and this great nation of Iran that should stay unified and fight these distortions and fight this sedition and fight this anarchy and destabilization inside Iran, this great government that supports the popular mobilization forces in Iraq.
Very well.
ISIS was taken over, yes, and supporting all the oppressed.
Zakir Ahmad Dumayet, on the issue of the normalization deals with the Israeli regime, do you think that these deals are intended to sow more division among regional countries?
Most definitely. It's an attempt to fracture the Muslim world. And so the loss of hope within the hearts of the Palestinian people. However, this is very clear from the Israeli sources. If you look at their military sources, they have admitted that this has been a colossal failure. The only thing that these Abraham Accords and these normalizations have proven to the world is that you have leaders who are prepared to trade values for economic advantage. This is the type of leadership that is running the Muslim world in large part, that they are prepared to trade their values for a few dollars. That is the exchange. And this has now created a very clear picture to the peoples of the world. Who do you support and who you don't? And this is particularly why, and I'll echo what my brother has said, that this is particularly why the Islamic Republic has been targeted with these recent wave of protests to try and sow discord and break the backs of the Iranian people and the Iranian nation and the support for the Palestinian people. This is not going to happen. These are the words of Ayatollah Ali Sayyid Khamenei, that they tried to sweep away the sapling of the Islamic Revolution, and they failed. And now it has grown into a mighty tree with very deep roots. You cannot topple this tree. And similarly, what they are trying to do is a two-phase project. One was normalization, trading your values for monetary gain. And the second one that is coming forward is that they are trying to sow the individual religion concept within the hearts of the Ummah instead of viewing it as a collective. So what it is that Islam is now religion for the individual, his own belief, and his own conscience, and therefore it opens the door to perversion. No, this is a collective religion. Our strength lies in our unity. And this was the underlying message of the 36th Conference of Islamic Unity. We must remain together. We must remain firm. And one of the key points that joins the hearts of everyone is this particular thing, that is the issue of Palestine. It's an issue of justice. It is an issue of truth. And you cannot turn a blind eye, because then you would be trading your own values and your own humanity.
For us, Najim, in your opinion, are the U.S. and the Israelis trying to depreciate the issue of the occupation? If Arab countries downplay it and do not prioritize it for the region, then it'll just be easier to get other countries to downplay it as well. Am I right?
Yes, for sure. I mean, the world is focused right now on putting sanctions on Iran. They're putting sanctions on Russia. Today, NATO president spoke out saying that, you know, he's against the annexation of Ukrainian lands and stuff like this. And then he never speaks about the Palestinian annexation and all the settlements and all the thefts and all the killings and Sheikh Jarrah. You know, where is this NATO? He only sees in one eye. He only sees one location or one area or one religion. I don't understand what these people see. It's all biased. They are, you can say they're racist. They're Islamophobic. You know, they're it's pure double standard, pure hypocrisy. They don't care about humanity. They only care about a certain type of humanity, you know, that's based on their, you know, like they have like the supremacy kind of like, you know, viewpoint and agenda. It's very, very bad what's happening in the world right now. But I think Sayyid Khamenei is setting the grounds. He's setting the right equations, and he's spreading awareness while the world is attacking him, you know, on a heavy level. We see on social media circulating major attacks on Sayyid Khamenei, calling him a dictator, where he has nothing to do with dictatorship. He's fighting the dictators. He's fighting the imperialist systems. He's fighting the Zionist regimes. He's trying to help people break out of these chains. He was elected by the assembly of experts. You know, he didn't even want to rule the country. He didn't even want power. Sayyid Khamenei stepped out of the his chair. He didn't want that. It was a big responsibility. But the assembly of experts, they pushed him and wanted him to stand there because they believed that he was the right man and he was the wisest man for this position. And Iran is a democratic Islamic system, and the world needs to understand this, that the Islamic democratic system is different than the Western hypocrisy and their so-called democracy that we see now. Freedom of expression is being suppressed on a heavy level, where they're taking people off the platforms on TikTok, on Instagram, on WhatsApp, on everything, just because they express a different view than their view and a different trend than their trend and a different direction than their direction. So they are exposing themselves. You know, they put sanctions on Press TV. Why would you do that? That's obviously you want to suppress another side and your opposition. That means you don't really believe in freedom of press. This slowly is exposing the real face of this so-called Western democracy and, you know, what they promote and say that okay. they are actually following.
Zakir Ahmed Mayet, we have about a minute left. I want to get your final thoughts to wrap up the program.
The final thought is that there's a very clear book that was written by Brigadier General S.K. Malik in 1979, The Quranic Concepts of War. And he says that the believer is constantly in a state of war against the principles of tyranny and persecution. It is our job to fight this. And we can only fight these injustices if we remain united. Wa atasim bi hablillahi jamian wa la tafarraqu. Do not hold on firmly onto the rope of Allah and do not divide amongst yourselves. We are all part of one ummah, as one of the key leaders of Hamas said at the conference, Dr. Khalid Ghadoumi. He said that we have one God, we have one book, and we have one Qibla. We need to remain united. It is a time of great change, and our hearts need to remain firm and connected to one another. And by the will of God, we will see justice within our lifetimes.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najim, joining us from Toronto, and attorney, activist, and political analyst Zakir Ahmed Mayet joining us from Johannesburg. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of Spotlight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The United States is not what you see in the flamboyant Hollywood movies. Normal life in the U.S. might surprise you, as the number of people without a stable place to call home has increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800 since the pandemic. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites. Stay tuned, please. The Hill wrote, "The typical American experiencing homelessness is often conceived of a mentally ill individual living in the subways of New York or an addict on the streets of San Francisco or Philadelphia. Those conceptions capture some of the crisis of homelessness, but not all of it. Among the 550,000 to 600,000 people experiencing homelessness in the U.S. are tens of thousands who are not chronically homeless, nor incapacitated due to illness or substance use disorder. These people are capable of work and ready to integrate into the mainstream job market. They are frequently overlooked in the debate on how we solve homelessness and also in publicly funded policy solutions." Works Fund combines paid work in social enterprise with transitional housing and support services for people not currently eligible for Housing First resources yet who are not self-resolving off the streets or out of shelters. Work programs act as a bridge for marginalized homeless populations with the capacity and desire to work to re-enter the workforce and obtain permanent housing. Tens of thousands of Americans fit that description. Solutions like work benefit not only their target population, but also the larger community through earnings, cost savings, increased labor hours, and more available housing. The three-pronged approach of the work model provides primary and secondary benefits, while its philosophy and implementation design allow for community integration and buy-in in a way that other strategies cannot. There has never been more urgency for employment-based solutions because of the ongoing labor shortage. The roughly 11 million jobs now unfilled represent a historic opportunity to increase employment among the homeless population. Employers are struggling to find workers, while over 70% of people experiencing homelessness are unemployed. And even those who are technically working are really underemployed. With more public support, work programs can develop relationships between local employers and municipal governments. Hill continued, "Homelessness is a symptom of many systematic failures of policy and practice in housing, behavioral health, workforce development, and the criminal justice system. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. It's past time to encourage innovation to develop programs that take into account the diversity of needs of people experiencing homelessness and promote the belief that those on the streets can and should be seen as assets to the community, as contributing members of society. Today, with homelessness on the rise in the U.S., U.S. citizens are perplexed by the lack of success their communities are having to adequately address this crisis." Also, Politico wrote, rising homelessness is tearing California cities apart. A crew of state workers arrived early one hot summer day to clear dozens of people camped under a dusty overpass near California's capital. The camp's residents gathered their tents, coolers, and furniture and shifted less than 100 feet across the street to city-owned land where they have been ever since. But maybe not for much longer. The city of Sacramento is taking a harder line on homeless encampments and is expected to start enforcing a new ban on public camping by the end of the month, if the courts allow. Also, Times of San Diego wrote, the first statewide snapshot of California's homelessness crisis since the pandemic hit reveals that the number of people without a stable place to call home increased by at least 22,500 over the past 3 years to 173,800. That's based on a Call Masters analysis of the federal government's point-in-time count, a biennial head count of people sleeping on the streets and in shelters tallied in by California cities and counties earlier this year for the first time since 2019. Homelessness experts mostly attribute the rise to precipitous drops in earnings during the pandemic among Californians already teetering on the edge. They also point to a worsening housing affordability crisis that is decades in the making. We have to solve this rotting core in the center of California, which is that we are a million units short of housing for exemplary low-income workers, said Margot Cochelle, director of the UCSF Benioff Homelessness and Housing Initiative. While homelessness grew by 15%, roughly the same space as in recent years, something experts credit to pandemic-era safety nets like rental assistance, eviction moratoria, and stimulus checks. The data also indicates the problem has gotten worse for the state's Latino population. Critics are quick to point out the state is spending more than $14 billion on homelessness, but advocates say its response is just now beginning. The price tag is bigger now, said Tomika Moss, founder and chief executive of All Home, a San Francisco-based homeless policy organization, saying, meanwhile, the inflow is killing us. The numbers show the state's investment in shelters is bearing fruit. California created more than 14,000 shelter beds between 2019 and 2021. And local organizations reported this year the number of people staying in emergency and longer stay shelters ballooned by nearly the same amount, from 42,800 to 57,200 people, a 33% increase since 2019. Christopher Ware, president of the Center for Homeless Inquiry, said, most people, most politicians, when they talk about homelessness, it's we're going to build X number of shelters. Shelter, shelter, shelter. Well, all of this construction of shelters doesn't really change the scope of the problem. Meanwhile, the unsheltered count or the number of people staying in tents, tarps, cars, and other spaces unfit for human habitation grew by 7% between 2019 and 2022 to 116,600 people. That's a bomb, but perhaps not reflective of the growing palpability of the crisis that dominates local headlines, political debates, and neighborhood discussions.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.